Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by returning guest Gulliver Giles, aka Thor, the sales warlord. Gulliver doesn't just teach sales, he forges it in fire. He's been called the best sales trainer on the planet, created the legendary Armor of God objection system, and helps clients hit seven figures in days, not months. From Necker Island with Branson to top stages around the globe, Gulliver is where rebellion meets results. He's the co-founder and owner of multiple companies, three key ones being Strategic Anarchy, The 8%, and Iron Cage, ranked among the top fast growth companies in Australia. If you hate not selling, he's your guy. So buckle up. I've asked him to join us here today to talk sales, life, and what it means to be a man in the modern world. So Gulliver, thank you for joining us, my friend. How are you doing?
Hey, man. I sound awesome. I want to be that guy. Thanks for having me, Daryl. Appreciate you, man.
Yeah, thanks for coming to the show. So now I know you. We've probably known each other for a long time now. But for those who don't, obviously I gave you a bit of your bio, but how did you even get into this world? Were your parents entrepreneurs? Did you pick up the torch and carry the flame?
My mum's a librarian. My dad's a professor. So they're really both dyed in the wool. What would you call them? Academics, right? But I was not like them. I was not introverted. I really didn't love high school. And I don't think I'm a stupid person. I'm certainly not anti-intellectual. If you want to go to university, fucking knock yourself out. But I dropped out of school in like year 10 and took a lot of drugs and played in a rock band in the 90s, like playing goth industrial music and chased girls and ate two-minute noodles and rice and lived on ramen sort of thing. And I was going to be Trent Reznor, except Trent Reznor was already Trent Reznor. I was going to be Robert Smith, except Robert Smith was already Robert Smith. And then it dawned on me that maybe dad was right. Maybe I should get a real job. So at the age of probably 25, 26, my beautiful cure head, spiky black hair started to fall out and my metabolism slowed down. And the girls who were chasing me the few years before were now running in the opposite direction. And all the signs were pointing to maybe you should get your shit together. So I cut all my hair off, put on a suit. I said to my friend, I don't know what to do with myself. If I'm not going to be a goth rock industrial musician, what am I going to do? And she said to me, Gulliver, you've always really been good at talking people into doing things. You know, when you were 14, you talked us into sneaking out of our parents' place and going down to the park and smoking weed and playing guitar. When you were 16, you were talking people at nightclubs into letting you in, even though you were underage. When you were 18, you were talking people into coming to your gig. You've always been good at talking to people. You should get into sales. You should do real estate. And I was like, I was very much that sort of socialist, broke musician at that point. So I was like, fucking sales, fuck that shit. Yeah. But for want of a better idea, I got into call center because I was good at talking to people. So I got into a call center and I discovered that in corporate, if you were good at your job, people rewarded you and you made more money. And that was revelatory for me. Because in the goth scene, if you were good at your job and you were good at being a good goth musician, everyone else would complain about you because they were jealous because they wished they had have started a band. And their imaginary band would be way better than your band.
Right.
Actually got off your ass and started. So similarly in corporate, people would still complain about the sales team. If you've been in corporate and you've been in sales, like, everyone's got something to say. Those guys are rude and they're obnoxious and they think they're better than everyone else and they make more money than us. And I could do their job totally, except it would mean making phone calls and talking to people and doing their job. But you don't want to do that, but you want to judge those guys. So I found that you got rewarded and I got promoted and became a manager of a team. And my girlfriend at the time, she was studying with a guy called Jay Abram. And if you don't know who Jay is, you know who Tony Robbins is. And Jay was the guy who told Tony Robbins to put late night commercials on. And that's what made Tony, gave him his break almost sort of thing. So Jay deals with little Fortune 500 companies like McDonald's and Baskin and Robbins and consults to big companies during the 70s and 80s and 90s. He's a pretty big name at that point. And my girlfriend, then my wife and CEO now, was giving him 25 grand a year to be in this business mastermind. And I was like, you're getting scammed. Like, you're making less than 50 grand a year and you're giving half of it to these guys and writing all of their books and all of their content and creating all of their marketing. They're making millions and you're making nothing. And she said, you're getting scammed because you're running a call center with 15 people selling cold calling out of the yellow pages back when they were like a 4-inch thick A and K and L and Z book. And you're calling and selling advertising in a magazine, but publishing is going to be fucked in the next few years. Your job's gone. And I'm like, whatever. I'm making 100 grand a year. You should come work for me and I'll show you. I'll fucking show you how to make sales and then you'll make some real money. 2 years later, I was working for her. So how I got into entrepreneurship was my wife was smarter than me, and my wife was the kind of person who invested in her education, and my wife was somebody who could see the future that I couldn't see. So I ended up following her and into this mess that is the digital marketing industry. Back in the day, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when information, yeah, like, so it was like, yeah, like it was 20 years ago that we got together, and it was about probably 17 years ago I got into her business, and she'd been doing it pretty much from the time we started. But create an information product, drive traffic to it was a big deal back then. No one was doing it, right? Now everyone's doing it. It's like pioneering shit back in the day. And then everybody in the marketplace was at their big 7 day free pitch fest multi-speaker event was saying, you just need to get on the internet and you need to market, and don't worry about selling, just market, because if you market well, you'll never have to make sales. And that might have been true at some point. Maybe I wasn't there that at that stage, but maybe back in the day of the internet when you were like one of two websites selling something, maybe that was true. It's certainly not true now, and it wasn't true by the time I hit the company. And it was like, I knew that you needed to get on the phone to close people into expensive shit. Maybe you'll sell something for $50 off a page, but if you want to close a $5, $10, $15, $20, $30,000 sale, you're going to have to talk to someone and add value to them. I ended up working with her on that. So I brought my sales skills from call center and my scripting skills from call center and put those together with her marketing skills. And for a while, for a short period of time, we were the only company in Australia doing marketing and sales. And everybody hated us because, oh, sales is evil and sales is bad. So we were kind of part of those few, mainly a couple of people in the industry at that point who were like, sales is a good thing and shouldn't be ashamed of it. And maybe, yeah, but that's the, and that's still around today and it's coming back in a big way. But because I think that people forget that what actually happens is no one gets helped until someone actually sells them something. So that's how I got started to tell a kind of short version of a long story. But I certainly wasn't my parents. Now, my parents were like, my mum wanted me to be a priest, I think, and my dad wanted me to be an academic, and they both wanted me to finish high school and probably go to university. And I looked at their life and I looked at where they were at, and they didn't have a life I wanted to have, and they were very angry at each other and getting a divorce. And I think that boomer model of success is go to school, get good marks, go to uni, get good marks, get a vocation, go and do that vocation and get a job and stay in that job for 30 years, get a divorce and stay in that job until you die. And that was their kind of model of what the world looked like. I didn't really want that. So I think I've always been a bit of a, like you said, a rebellious kid, a punk rocker. I wanted to do something different. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs come from that too. Not everybody was born with a platinum spoon in their ass. Like some people just, they didn't get into entrepreneurship because they wanted to, but because it was the only way that they could make something of themselves. I think that probably is why I did it. Yeah.
A lot of people, I think they're frustrated with the way things are, and so they want to build something better.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
that's how free markets are supposed to work. Markets are ultimately unknown and unknowable.
Yeah.
Right? If I ask you how many people are in market to buy a car today, there's keyword traffic and cell phone data, but ultimately, oh, nobody really knows. It's unknowable and it's constantly fluctuating. But everyone can acknowledge excellence. So the idea is that you could have localized producers and suppliers of things, and everybody votes on the most excellent solution with their dollars. That's how it's supposed to work. Anyways, so for someone that is listening to this, maybe starting out or struggling, what would you recommend to them? You've done sales training for so long, you've got software around it. What are the key pillars that need to be done?
Oh, look, I think that's a big question, right? But if we have to boil it down, I think the thing that you have to have right, and I was just on a coaching call with one of my clients earlier, and we're talking about this, is you have to know that what you're doing is valuable. It's like that. If you don't have that, you got nothing. So, like, I get so many people, and you probably see this too on the internet. And 10 years ago, they were a high ticket closing expert. 9 years ago, they were a Bitcoin expert. And then every year, their expertise and thing that they're jumping onto changes, but their first job and last job was fry chef at McDonald's. There's a lot of dudes out there who've leapt on to that bandwagon of whatever they think is the big thing that's going to be easy to sell that's working now. But there's no intrinsic value in that. And I think this is where people fall down with sales and opportunism, and is that they haven't really thought through, who is the person I'm actually going to serve? What does that person really need? Am I selling something that's intrinsically valuable? What's my edge here? What's my unique value proposition? What am I really doing on this phone call? So I had a guy just before, he's like, I didn't make any calls yesterday. And he's paying me like 36 grand a year to be coached. And I'm like, what did you do instead? He goes, I texted these guys. I said, look, you know what my recommendation is? I want you to do as many calls as you possibly can to people every single day until you've broken through your cash flow target. And he's like, yeah, it's like, I have this story that I've made up about how if I call people and it's not a planned call that I'm interrupting them. I said, look, tell me more about why you think that's true. And he's like, I don't like it when people call me without letting me know they're going to call. I said, look, that's fine. And you have that bias. But if you don't feel like your call is the most important call in the world for these people and worth interrupting whatever the fuck else they've got going on today, you'll always be lacking in self-confidence. You'll always be the sales demon. The sales demon's in your ear saying, you shouldn't call that person. Mm. And you'll always be his bitch. You'll always be the sales demon's bitch, because that demon on your shoulder will always be, that person doesn't want to talk to you. If you're not like, whatever this guy is doing, it's not as important as what I'm going to be doing for him. So I'm going to call him and I'm going to cut through and interrupt his day and deliberately interrupt everything in order to stop him in his tracks and sell him this thing, because he has to have it. Because it's going to make a huge difference for him and his life and his clients and his family. And it's going to make a huge difference for me because I'm going to make money for my family. That, if you don't have that,
yeah,
you've got no motivation to get on the phone. And there's always going to be that sales demon in your ear saying, yeah, you could just go and do something else rather than be on sales calls right now. And I think so many people fall difficult. Like, whether you're an entrepreneur or whether you're an intrapreneur in someone else's company making sales, if you don't feel that edge, it's because you're not super crystal fucking clear on the value of what you do. And if you're not super crystal clear on the value of what you do and what it does for people, why would you get on the phone and brave the uncertainty of that person maybe doesn't like you? Or maybe they don't want to talk to you. Because that's what we're all frightened of. As humans, we're hardwired. Like from the days of the Ice Age, if the tribe don't like me, I will get left behind in the ice and the saber-toothed tigers are going to come and get me. We've been dealing with that uncertainty for millions of years before we became monkeys that kind of have iPhones and shit like that, right? So that's still there in the back of our DNA. Our programming is don't be unlikable, get along with everyone. But the problem is fitting into the tribe in the Ice Age is not being an entrepreneur in 2025. Like now, our job is to stand out and be the fiercest, most compelling, ballsiest, most assertive, different, best version of what we do than everyone else who wants to compete with us. Like, following is not leading and leading is not following. So you can't stand out and fit in. So you need to make that decision. Am I following the tribe? If so, employment in a non-sales role is probably better for you. If you are an entrepreneur, if you are a salesperson, you need to be a leader. You need to be like, I know better than this person. I know better than this person. And I'm going to reveal it to them on this sales call. And I'm going to have to interrupt them. I'm going to have to cut through their shit and be more certain than that to get them to that point, right? So if you don't have that value, if you don't know what your value is, if you're not clear on your value, and then and you got a pretty good idea that person you're talking to is going to value what you've got once you get through to them, then you're screwed before you begin, if that makes sense. Yeah,
Sense. And it's great. Yeah. It's very counterintuitive, because for someone that's in that situation, it means you need to keep working. You need to get back to work on what you're offering then. If you don't have that conviction, then maybe what you're selling is just a piece of junk. And you actually need to improve on what you're selling, because especially in today's transparent world, people might have got away with snake oil in the past, but today's era and today's age, the world is so transparent. You can be collecting money from people right now, and in a couple hours, you start racking up bad reviews. And all that, you just have to, it's like fighting through mud. You have to overcome that. Now, you don't want to have analysis by analysis either, and wait forever to launch. So now you have to have integrity and sell people on the vision and let them know that this is minimum viable product one or minimum viable products or service one type thing. And just, I think, be candid with people and transparent. Look, this is where we're at and it's not perfect. Let me rub some shiny off of this thing for you. And this is what it is, but it's going to help you get from A to B. I love that, because I've got kids and kids are great salespeople. Like, they just, the tenacity, the resilience, they want it so bad in their heart. They don't care if you got rejected. They'll do everything. They'll do everything. So I think it's a fantastic tip.
Yeah, man. I think, like, you as a marketer, offer is like, pixels and SEO and Facebook or wherever your media channel is or whatever the algo is or whatever the freaking disposition of the people on that channel. That's all variables, but what's axiomatic and what doesn't change is offer. And if your offer is shit, 50% of success isn't, it's not about manipulation of the media. It's about, is the offer any good in the first place? And that's the big hit. Like those little one percenters of all the other shit that people focus on. Most marketers these days are not worthy of the name. They're technologists. They're people who've figured out how to use the Facebook platform or whatever it is, but they're not marketers. They haven't figured out who is the niche, who's the ideal client, why do they need this? Why? How do I craft such a compelling offer that they're like, holy fucking shit, click, I need that. In the sales process, like Leela says, sales is about, I'm sorry, marketing is about getting them to the door, but then sales is about getting them through the door. So when I was calling the Yellow Pages, it was like, hey, are you in this industry? Yes. Do you know this group of people? Yes. We run a magazine for them. Would you like to get in front of them? Yes. That was enough of a psychological foothold. Okay, I know I represent this major group of consumers of this person's product. That was my foothold. That was my value. I knew I had at least that much brand recognition that I could get. Yeah. Maybe get a conversation started, right? Because yeah. I represented a group of people that might buy from them. So that's the kind of the change that digital marketing made for me was I was calling someone who had literally downloaded a thing from us, who knew who we were,
yeah,
and wanted to know what we had to say. It was even stronger. It's like, dude, you just downloaded a white paper on how to restructure sales teams for more profitability. Yeah, I read that. That's a horror story. I can't believe you had to fire all those people, but you managed to pull it back from the edge and change everything. Yeah. Dude, I really resonated with that because our team's doing similar shit. We should talk.
Yeah.
Way yeah. more powerful. Most people have never cold called, have never called the Yellow Pages and built a relationship from nothing. Most people consider calling a qualified lead like that and developing a two-way conversation to be cold calling and so hard and so unethical. From my point of view, it's like it's the psychological foothold is like you deliberately put your details down, self-selected, put your hand up.
Yeah.
For you are now engaged in a two-way conversation with me. You are now, you're actually half interested in what I'm talking about. That's like miraculous for an 80s or 90s salesperson.
Yeah.
But the young kids today are like, I don't even want to call people. I saw an ad on LinkedIn the other day. I sound like a fucking old man. I am an old man. Old man yelled at people on the cloud, right? I saw this ad the other day, cold text like a pro. And I was like, what? It takes guts to send a text message now. Like, that's where we're fucking at. But it's all about value. And if these guys really understood the value, maybe they'd be able to get out of their own selfish, cowardly bullshit and add some fucking value to someone and be a bit more assertive and pick up their phone and ring them so they're not sending an ignorable email or an ignorable text, but they're actually making change with people. And I think that's the value is the reason why not. They're not really clear in the value that they're actually able to create for that person. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. That's powerful. So in your own career, I mean, you talked about kind of then versus now. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced? Like, was it all sunshine and rainbows? You got hired by this call center and then you were just ordained good and the pearly gates opened and you got promoted. And then you left work with Leela and money rained from the sky and it was all sunshine and rainbows.
Oh man, no, fuck no. I don't think anyone in entrepreneurship or sales is attending a ticker tape parade in their honor every day where rose petals are thrown before their feet and free blowjobs happen after every sales call. Like if there is such a place, I'm sure everyone wants to go work at that company, but no, it's called work for a reason, right? Yeah. Call center. My first job was doing market research, calling people at 7 o'clock at night, getting told to get fucked because you're ringing people at dinner time. And my second job was, what was I doing? Optus call center. So Optus was like your telco, right? Telecommunications. So again, ringing people and trying to get them to change their telecommunications plan from the one they're on that they're paying a particular amount to this one where they're going to pay exactly the same amount, but with different swings and roundabouts, and there's no value in it, but it's just what you got to sell. And people are also telling you to get fucked a whole bunch. And then I went to work in a massive inbound call center for a bunch called Ticketmaster 7, which was heavily scripted. If you picked up the phone and you didn't read the script, there would be someone in a booth somewhere QOing that call, and you get dragged into an office with the freaking floor manager and your team leader and threatened with being fired. And like all of that built a thick skin, built resilience, all of that pain and challenge going into that call center role at the Building Association for this group of major builders in construction in a tough time. That was, we were hired initially because their insurance company had gone bankrupt. And what that meant was, to get a home built in Australia, you have to have a certificate of insurance that protects you and your consumer. So, you know, if you die or you go bankrupt halfway through building their house, they have someone else to come in and fix it. They have money to fix it. So if you can't get that insurance, you can't start a build. If you can't start a build, you can't sell a house. And if you can't sell a house, guess what's happening? So most construction companies, like 30% of them go bankrupt. They're not good at managing their money. They're carpenters. They become builders. No one teaches them how to run a company, run marketing, run sales, run ops. They're marginal at best, right? But after 3 or 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks of not being able to make a sale, most businesses, if I went 8 weeks without making a sale, I'd probably start to shit myself. So that's what we were hired to deal with, was these inbound complaint calls with people like calling us, threatening to come down with a shotgun and shoot us if we didn't come up with their insurance policies. And they're very angry. I had to talk to them down off a tree because we had nothing to sell them, and active listen and learn to, like, almost we were trained in hostage negotiation tactics by a consultant they brought in to talk these guys down off the ledge of threatening us with violence to get them to be more calm and to feel like reassured. And then the suicide started, like dudes started killing themselves because they were losing their businesses and failing their wives and their families and their company that their dad handed them, that his dad handed him. People were losing legacies. It was a really shitty start to the job, but I did such a good job of that and showed up and kept on being the best I could be, that they promoted me into the sales area and said, hey, come and here's a nice shiny car and go and see these guys and sell them memberships in the association. So I did. And that fucking sucked. It was hard. Like, no one trained me. There was no script. There was no guide rails. Like, here's the keys to the car. You've got 20 this week. I'm sorry, you got to sell 20 this month. And if you don't, you're going to lose this job. So it was very pressurized. And then I got really good at that. Without kind of having any real training or scripting or objection handling or how to make an offer, it was just like call people and do what you do and off you go. It was very, you just rely on your own kind of intuition. So I did that. Then someone said, hey, I'm leaving this place and I'm going to go set up a call center. Come and work for me. This was my mentor at the time. So I did. And we went 6 months there and it was like hundreds of cold calls. And I was the only one hitting any kind of sales target. It was commission only. And that was where we were selling ad space for the Builders Association's magazine. So we jumped ship and went work for their publisher. And that was really hard. Like, it was, again, that was, those guys gave us some training. It was AIDA, attention, interest, decision, action. Here's how you run your sales call. And we'd call these guys and again, get mostly told to get fucked. 120, 150 calls a day. But out of all the people on the floor, I was the best at it. And then my manager said, I don't like this. He was a face-to-face, go see business development manager kind of guy. And call center really wasn't what he thought it would be. So he left. So they said, hey, Gulliver, do you want the job? And I said, oh, fuck, okay, I guess so, because it meant a pay rise. And that was my first management role. And all of a sudden, I'm managing 15 people. And I had to figure out how to manage people. And managing people is cool because you get an overrider on what they're selling. You get a little clip of everything they sell. But you don't get significant bonuses unless you meet certain targets. And nobody in the company's ever met these targets. It happens every now and again, but it doesn't really happen all that often. You know, at this point, my wife says to me, you're working for these dudes and your targets are set beyond where you're capable to achieve them. I was like, no. She's like, yeah, check it out. Who else has made that? Oh, Sydney did it 2 weeks ago. Have you ever heard of anything before that? No. Do you think they'd be crowing to you every week if it was happening regularly? I'm like, yeah, they probably would. She goes, you should come work with me and be a sales trainer. I'm like, no one would ever. I was so broken. I was so lacking in confidence because I felt like I was a fucking piece of shit and a dumbass because I felt like I was failing. And she's like, how much money did you make your company last week? I'm like, 50 grand. She's like, cool, what's that every month? I'm like, I've never done these numbers. Oh, 200 grand. She's like, so how much is that a year? I'm like, $2.4 million. She's like, yeah, so do you think there's people out there that don't know how to make $2.4 million a year? And I'm like, yeah, but that's not my money. She's like, what do you mean? I only get paid a percentage of that. She's like, do you think anyone gives a fuck whether you get to keep the money or not? Do you think they want to know how to create a team that makes them millions and millions of dollars a year? Do you think there's, put it this way, Gulliver, I'm in this J. Abram group and there's a bunch of people in this program, they're making $100,000, $200,000 a year. Do you think they would like to know how to make $2.4 million? Yeah. No. So I eventually summoned up the courage to sell this one guy sales training, and I sold it to him for $1,000 and I gave him like 5 one-on-one hours across the course of the week.
What a deal.
He made $3,000 back that week. And I said, do you want to do another week? He said, yeah, sure. So he did another week. He made six. And then he said, I think I've got this. Like, he's put down 2 grand and he's made like fucking 9. He went away and made $600,000 in the next 6 months in his startup business. And I'm like, I am fucking screwing myself over here. You met me when I was doing a lot in America with
Yeah,
Frank.
I was Maria Whalen's guest, and that's where I met
Yeah,
her.
Maria.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 5 years later, I'm actually doing quite well and running seminars all over the world. And Ryan Dice and Roland Fraser see that I'm working with Frank, and they opt in for the promotion that Frank Kern's doing, where we do business together, doing a 9 day sales intensive where we lock you in a house and force you to make $1 million. And he starts promoting me, and they get on the phone, and Roland's, hey, you know what you're doing with Frank? Could you do that with us? I said, look, I can, but Frank set me up with you. Like, I got you as a lead through our joint venture, so I'd feel weird just saying yes and coming and working with you. Why don't we get together with me and you and Frank and Leela and sit down and talk about what we can do together? So being stupidly loyal, as I always am, like to a fault, I don't just take opportunities, and like I try and credit the people around me and pay them back. So we did that. And we sit down at this big country club in La Jolla, and it's like in one of those gated neighborhoods with like guards with submachine guns, and all the cars are like brand new freaking McLarens and shit out the front of this fucking crazy castle looking kind of place. And all the houses in this valley look like they're from the south of France or Tuscany or some shit. It's fucking crazy rich dude land. And I'm like, okay, this is just a little bit intimidating. And Leela, because there was the cruise ship that came into San Diego the night before, Leela and most of the people from my seminar that week went down with Noro, and I didn't have it, but Leela was in bed. So the CEO, the leader, the entrepreneur, the visionary can't make the meeting with Perry Belcher, Roland, Frank, like all the big dogs. And I'm sitting there, fuck, I don't know what I'm doing here. So anyway, it turned out okay. Frank's like, you should hire this guy to come in and train your sales team, because they were launching something called Funnel Experts, which is like a $15,000 done with you, build your sales funnel. And back then, I don't know if you remember the Tripwire and the Profit Maximizer, all
That
that. Oh, that was the product. So they were like, look, we're going to launch this thing. We've always sold off our online advertising completely. All of our courses are just sold off page. We'd sell some war room $25,000 ahead events at our traffic and conversion once a year. But other than that, we don't make sales calls. We don't call our list. What do we do? So we sat down with them, and I think we quoted them $25,000 for 2 days, which I pooed my pants over, because it's like these guys are doing $30 million and I'm doing like $1.8 million, and they know way more than me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, what do I charge them? And they charge them $150,000. And she's sick in bed. I can't walk you through this, Gulliver. I feel so sick. And I'm like, I chickened out and charged 25. On the second day, after sitting down and screaming over the table about how the sales script should work with Roland and Frank and arguing back and forth about the strategy and put together the sales script, and the second day we put them on the phone, they made 75 grand. And then they got on the phones next week and made 90. And then the next week they made 200. And the next week they made 300. And I think they probably, if they continued on in that vein, we're looking at like $12 million in recurring monthly revenue, roughly on a $30 million company. So that takes them to 40 something. I think what actually happened was after a few months, Frank freaked down and shut everything down because they were making so many sales. He was worried they couldn't fulfill on it. So that's how successful that was. And I'm sitting there, what the fuck, man? I did it again. And I think every time I think I'm charging a lot of money, the company makes more money. So look, I think the biggest pain, the biggest hardest thing that I've had to deal with is the urge to devalue myself and feel insecure and
I think
be
that's just your
intimidated.
value prop. Like I get what you're saying because I've been there. Like I've charged 50 grand for services and said, sorry, you got to pay up front or I'm not going to lift a finger. But I also think you got to leave some meat on the bone for them at the same time. So I get what you're saying and I've been there in your shoes, but I also think that's part of what creates, like everybody wants to see the guru. Nobody wants to see the guru at the bottom of the mountain. And there's like a mysticism. And so even though you have that, you're still leapfrogging where you were at. And I think the results you're helping these people get builds that legend of Gulliver, if that makes sense. Like, I'm not trying to make sense, but I think part of
Yeah,
it.
but I think the problem is you get so attached to, because we're all human and we have mental frailties, we have emotional things go up and down, things change, you get older. The older I get, the less cocksure and certain I am of myself. The more when you're 30, you know fucking everything.
Everything. Oh, yeah.
100% certain of it. And that arrogance and that ego, what is the often wrong, never in doubt? You make a lot of blunders, but you never feel a sense of doubt about anything. As you get older, you get wiser, you become less certain, you become less sure, and you become more measured. But I look back and I'm like, I should have believed in the evidence of my own eyes a lot more rather than in the fear or the emotion or the attachment to results. So if I could go back and do it all again, it would be probably with a lot more. Let's look at this as from the business of how much can I add to this person and how can I help them? What's their gap and what's that likely worth for them versus how can I undercut myself? Because I think I did. I've made millions and millions of dollars, but I probably could have made a lot more. And I probably will in the future because I'm less likely to do that. So now if the guy on the other end of the phone doesn't take the deal because they don't value what I've got, I'm less worried about it than I used to be because experience has shown me that I know my value, but I didn't always have that. So I guess the lesson for those listening is like, look at what the value is for the person that you're going to sell. It comes back to value again, right? Look at what the value of the transformational value of what you do is for the person. Look at the impact you're making because the hardships, the tough times are constant in business. Like people think this amount of money they're going to get one day, they're going to make a particular amount of money and it's going to solve their problems. Their wife's going to be happy and there's going to be the ticker tape parade and the rose petals and all of that sort of stuff. But it's not really true. And it doesn't work. Life doesn't work like that. There's constant ups and downs. You're always going to have emotions. You'd be making millions of dollars and your father-in-law still passes away. And you'd be making millions of dollars and your wife's grandmother passes away 2 weeks later. And you can be making millions of dollars and your eldest dog still died 6 months later. You can have the worst year ever in 2024 and be very successful financially and fucking and hate everything. And that was 2024 was a rough year. And as you get older and you get less egoic and less certain, showing up and being balanced and wise is your friend. So if you could be balanced and wise now, wherever you are in your journey, if you're listening to this and you're like, does it get better? No, but you do. In fact, life tends to get harder. Yes, more money is good, but more money solves money problems, but it doesn't solve.
Yeah, money solves all problems that lack of money creates, but that's it. And that it can do a lot for you, but it can't do everything. And you can't take it with you. And once your money problems are solved, what's left there in the silence? Sometimes I know of a couple of guys that sold a business, older guys, I think in their 60s, and they spent building this business. And one had kids and a family and all this. And the other guy had nothing. He was single. He like that business was his life. And after they sold it, he went to Latin America and ended up committing suicide. Because he had 8 figures in a bank account, liquid. Like he could have done anything, but it was just he lost his life purpose. And that's really shocking for people. One thing I want to mention and talk about, because I think for some people, they'll really empathize with you, but there's a yeah, but, and it was because of your skill to do outreach, to do the 120, 150 calls a day. Don't, and a lot of the people you work with have solved the problem of throughput. And that's something people listening to this where they're like, I could never do that. Part of the ability to have the confidence to walk away is knowing there's more deals that you can go get. And huge percentage of people don't understand how to generate throughput. Can you speak to that a little bit for someone that's in that situation?
You can crawl at the wall or you can run at it, right? There's a wall there either way. So the longer it takes you to do the thing that builds the momentum, the more fatiguing it is and the more despair you're going to feel. Whereas if you do the 120 calls a day and you do them every day, very soon you have so much more pipeline that you could possibly choose from. And at that point, it's okay, now I can afford to pick and choose. Like I've got 30 people in my mastermind paying me $3,000 a month, and I've got 10 people in my ultra high level one-on-one coaching paying me $10,000 a month. I've got people coming to my retreats. I don't have to take a deal I don't want to take. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. Because I think that part is like people, they just don't even know how do I, so what? I just, how do I, where do I get the names to call 120? Like I just, what? I just start walking up to the stores in the mall going, hi, can I speak to the manager?
Well, I
That's.
mean, look, here's the thing. Like, it depends on where you're at in your journey. But if you're a raw startup and you've got fucking nobody, you have a zero list, and I've been there, there are businesses everywhere that need what you have, right? There are people everywhere that need what you have. So, what you've got to really think of, and I go through this a lot with people who are like zero, but they have an idea or they have a product or they've got something they want to sell. It's like, all right, where are the people who are going to buy the product? I don't know. Who are the people? They're these people. Great. If you know who your niche is and you know where they're congregating, like I know if I get up at 4:30 in the morning and I drive into my deer hunting patch and I get there at about 5 o'clock in the morning and the sun's coming up at 5:30 in the morning, I'm there half an hour before light begins and I trundle down the path to the section of the path where the river is down the hill from the path. The deer are coming up from the river where they've been drinking and they're heading for the high ground where they're going to sleep. I know if I'm coming down that path at the right time of day when the deer are coming up, and over the path and up the river, I'm probably going to see a deer on that path. And almost every time I go hunting in that spot, there's a deer at that spot. Sometimes, if I'm lucky and I get my rifle up in time before they see me and run away, I've got some deer in the freezer. People aren't thinking about that when you go fishing. If
Yeah.
your strategy is to sit on the high tide line and wait for whatever washes up on the high tide, you are eating dead seagulls. You are eating rotten freaking jellyfish. You are eating seaweed. That's your dinner tonight. Congrats. But if you're like, if I actually want to catch a fish to feed my family, I need to be where the big gutter is on the beach, where the big fish feed. And I need to be there when the big fish are feeding, which is going to be, if possible, on the full moon. It's, if possible, dawn or dusk, where they're more likely to be feeding, and if possible, on a running out tide. If possible, a bait or a lure that looks like the little fish the big fish eat. And if I fish right at that right spot, right at that right time, with the right bait and the right lure, I've got a gigantic snapper straight off the beach. Oh, it's a miracle. How did you do that? I knew who my fucking fish was and where he would be and why. So if you don't know where all these numbers are, you really haven't done the fucking work on who is the person you really want. So most people are like, oh, I'm going to start a business. Cool. What? Why? Because I've got this amazing idea or this product that I'm going to sell. Great. But who are the people that buy? Oh, anyone could use it. And that is like going into the forest with a deer rifle, firing a bullet and hoping it hits dinner.
Yeah.
Now, if you've ever gone deer hunting, it's hard enough to hit a deer when you're fucking aiming at it. You're as blind as I am anyway. I feel bad for the deer. But if you're looking at that approach to sales and marketing, like, I'm just going to blast this out there and hope it hits someone, you're really gambling your house and your kids' fucking college fund on that. But if you're very deliberate and you put your cross here, this exactly, Daryl is 35 to 40 years old. He has been very successful in this area, but his great big problem actually now is this. And if he doesn't fix this and this, he's in trouble. I know where Daryl's hanging out.
Yeah.
I know what he's up to. Hey, Daryl, are you going through this and this? Fuck, how did you know? I had a pretty good guess because you've been doing this. Wow, man, it's like you've been reading my emails. Yeah, dude. So what I want to talk to you about today, only if you're open to it, is this and this. And if you like it, great. If not, that's cool too. How do you feel? Oh, okay. Tell me more. Look, before we get into that, let me ask you some questions.
Boom. I love it.
If you haven't bothered to think about your customer and what he's going through, then you don't have that foothold. You don't have the value, which is what we keep talking about.
No, I love that. I had a crash course on that for 3 months. I drove taxi after coming back from Japan to Canada. And that was like, okay, I'm in a car. This is for people that don't know, taxi drivers didn't used to have apps. You'd have to sit in the car and you go, okay, I'm not making any money. I need to find someone that needs somewhere to go. Who needs to go somewhere right now? Geez, it's morning. Maybe someone needs to go to work. Okay, so where do people live? And then you start trying to reverse engineer, and then you start learning the airplane schedule and the train schedule and the school schedule and the lunch hour schedule and where people are going from where to where and the movie schedule. And you start learning these places, like you said, where you hang out and maybe you get someone. And I think that's just such a great and powerful analogy. And this comes back to what you're saying before. We could almost start a whole new podcast on this topic, but I know you've been talking about wanting to take men fishing and hunting and talking about how there's like, talked about these skills that we developed over these millions of years. And how so now, because everyone's just sitting alone on their computer in their little room, they're so detached from the real world and the reality. And there's so many social skills that have been lost, that some of these innate talents that we have that are latent and hidden and dormant, that's actually what they need to achieve the next level in their lives to a certain extent, is bridging the connection between the two. I love that. What do you think are going to be some of the most important skills and behaviors moving into?
I think we're looking at this time where I spent $2 million a year over the last, not $2 million a year. I've spent $2 million over the last 15 years on sales and marketing, training and education. The last sales course I bought, and I still buy education, even though I'm an expert and blah, 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 was like 160 grand. I invested a lot in my training because I want to be good. If you don't get good, if you're not constantly striving. And now ChatGPT is here, and now AI is here. And now I'm on a sales call with someone and they're ChatGPTing, second guessing whether I have expertise or not. And my advice, I like to think, is better than ChatGPT's. But people worship ChatGPT like a fucking god. So if you're in sales and you're in consulting and you're in marketing and you think you're good, you're not safe. You're not safe. So how can you be safe? How can you provide security for yourself, for your family? Is you need to get good at doing things that aren't replaceable. You need to do things that are rare and valuable, that are human. You need to get better at humaning. You need to get better at being an irreplaceable human. What does that look like for you? It might probably be different than it looks like for me, but I guess what it comes down to for me as a heterosexual male, I am very, just like everybody else, indoctrinated into this idea that I must provide. Yes, I'm here to provide and to protect and to somehow prevail over what's going on in the world on a daily basis to make sure that my family are going to be okay, that my tribe are going to be okay. So I think what we've got to double down on is, what does that fucking mean now? Because it's changed. I think as providers, like if you're just providing a paycheck, but you're not providing presence and love and nurture, you are fucking lost. You're going to lose your relationship and you're not going to have a great relationship with the kids either, probably. Yeah. And I think if you blow that out to business, it's the same thing. Like as a boss, just signing the paycheck for your employees, that's one thing. But being the person that nurtures them, mentors them, holds space for them, grows them in a time where portability has gone from people stay in their job on average 10, 20 years to 5 years to 3 years. God knows what Gen Z are going to do. Gen Z don't even want to come to their job because they're just busy being a fucking Instagram OnlyFans star or whatever it is. The world's changing so quickly. And I sound like an old fuck, because I am. But if you don't fucking cut through, the people say to me, have you ever hired a person under the age of 30? Like, yes, actually I have. And some of my best employees are women under the age of 30. Yeah. And I have a team of women in the States right now who are like in their mid 20s pulling 30 grand weeks. And they're like, oh, how do you get them to show up? I said, well, you've got to do better than you're doing right now, because all you are to them is a paycheck right now. Providing just the paycheck, whether as a father or whether as a leader, you've got to provide the presence. You've got to provide more than that. You've got to provide that nurture. You've got to make space for them, care about them, be a human being at them. The advantage right now is being human more than ever before, but you've got to be a better human. And that's probably key. And in terms of protection, we're sold this idea, particularly as young men, that we have to be physically strong and imposing and be able to protect our woman from the rapists and the monsters in the world. It's like, no. Most likely, statistically, you're going to be the one who abuses, is controlling, is violent, is aggressive. Men who are married kill their wives more often than anybody else. Mm. Yeah. You've got to protect her against you. Mm. Yeah. You've got to be mentally strong. You've got to make space for yourself. Go hunting, go fishing, do things that make you feel happy. Fulfill yourself, refill your cup, and come to your marriage as a rock. And knowing when to be strong and tough and knowing when to be soft is an art form, which you'll never get. Like, I'm still working on it. I'm not perfect, but providing for her in that emotional way and protecting her from your own psychoses and your own bullshit and your own shit up in your head about how you're not good enough, and not vomiting all your crap all over her, or being loud or angry or aggressive or abusive or cracking the shits when she wants your help. That's something that years of therapy and coaching and personal development, it's easy for me to say. Yeah, you got to get good at that. But it cost me years to get good at that. Yeah. And that's the way to prevail. And that's the only way you're going to grow a business or have a good relationship or be a good dude, I think, is getting honest about where you're falling down. And the biggest place I think we're all falling down is being good humans. We really are. So I think that's probably what to work on, because that's the only thing you can really control. You can't control what technology is going to do next, but you can be a good man. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. That's really powerful. That's super powerful. And I think that's being, I don't know if it's redefined, because I think it's probably been the same through the ages. It just gets covered in bullshit and concrete. And then we have to go, no, that was a mistake. It's not what it is.
Yeah.
And then we have to go back to the core, so to speak.
Yeah. I think there's some issues confronting masculinity, and there always have been, but like we use this stuff as a stick to beat other dudes with and feel superior. And I don't think that's the answer. And we use this stuff to beat up on women with. I was like, oh, women are the problem. So women aren't the problem. We need to win to work on ourselves and be better. And I think like that we do that in cooperation and collaboration and fucking making space for each other and witnessing each other, not in tearing each other down or judging one another. And that's hard, because we're all very judgmental little bastards. And we all want to be the best. We all want to be
the best. Well, I think judgment's part of survival. If you weren't the anxious one, so to speak, you didn't survive. You talk about like walking in the woods. If you're
100%.
Yeah. And so that's now turned into sort of this fault finding default that we have, which we need, but it's like a double-edged sword, right?
Book. Yeah. There's a book called A Hunter in a Farmer's World, which is about ADHD. So I'm an ADHD late life realized. My wife said, take this quiz. And the thing about ADHD is not a disease or a disability so much as it is the culmination of millions of years worth of, there's a crack in the bushes over there. What was that? Is it a deer? Is it a saber-toothed tiger? Those skills, being a hunter, like those skills are like valuable in the right setting. If you are a warrior or a hunter and you're out there What's that? That hypervigilance is very useful, but in your everyday, it will make you a fucking crazy person. And if you then try and build things to control others around you or to dominate others around you,
Yeah, that's too
you
much.
want to protect yourself from your shit, and like you want to protect yourself from your wife who loves you, or your children who are aggravating you, or your clients, and you're constantly in that state of cortisol burnout and fear and hypervigilance. That's where most of the world is right now.
Oh,
And
yeah.
when you realize that, it gives you huge revelatory power. You're like, oh shit, I don't have to be like that. I don't have to buy into that. And you're right about judgment. Like without judgment, you lack judgment. We do have to judge constantly. We do have to judge. And I think what's exhausting about being a human being right now is we are being called to make a lot more decisions and a lot more rapidly than we have ever had to ever before. The level of data and input and threat we have to process every fucking second of the day is more than it's ever been. Like if you think about when we were cavemen, that crack in the bushes in the woods would happen like once a day.
Yeah, in terms of information overload.
Then you killed the deer and you went home with the deer on your back, and all the women of the tribe said, "Whoa, look at that guy. I make babies with him. He's a strong hunter." And life was good until the next time you had to go out in the woods and deal with the uncertainty and the problems. Now, every time your phone goes off, it could be a sale, it could be a refund, it could be a lawsuit, it could be the fucking tax department. Constant threat, constant hypervigilance, constant overload. How do you deal with that? Put your fucking phone down and go to the forest.
Yeah. Also, my phone doesn't
The
ring.
sacred mushroom.
It
Be
doesn't ring
still for an hour.
for shit. My phone doesn't
Sorry.
ring for shit. My phone is my tool to interact with the world. It's not the tool for the world to interact with me. So it doesn't beep. It doesn't ring. It doesn't vibrate. It nothing. It's there. The
Yeah.
notifications pop up, but like right now, it's face down. It doesn't even exist to me. If I'm not, that's the thing is, yeah, I think it's going to be an exciting 10 years, and I'm optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic. I would put it that way.
If it goes well, it will give us a whole new way of being. If it goes poorly, we'll deal with it. But I think the chances are it'll probably do both. So I think it's like be hope for the best, but prepare for the worst and come up with strategies to be a better human being, because that's what, at the end of the day, when you strip it all back, that's all you've really got.
I love this. We could talk for four. I'm gonna have to have back at some point for a follow-up. But for people that have enjoyed this, if they want to plug in and follow or subscribe, what are the best ways for them to get in touch to?
There are so many different websites and promotions and shit that we've got running all the time, but the best way is probably still check me out on Facebook, hit me up. Like I'm Gulliver Giles on Facebook. There's not too many of me. There's only one actually in the world, Gulliver Giles. So if you want to look me up, hit me up with a friendship. Do me a favor, just message me and say, "Yo, Daryl's podcast, loved it, hated it. Talk to me." Because I think social media, what it's good for, and no one really uses it for. People friend you up and they hope that you're going to drop some amazing content on them. And I've got like 5,000 friends at any given moment because everyone thinks they're going to get the answer to the keys to the kingdom of the billions of dollars in the successful business and blah, blah, blah from some shit I say. I do not post content on Facebook. I make comments about cats and post photos of hunting trips, and it's all just lifestyle shit. It's not like I'm not going to coach you on Facebook, but if you engage with me and use social media as a social interaction tool, as you should, say, "Hey, Gulliver, I saw your stuff. Tell me more about things." If you actually talk to me and have a two-way conversation with me, there's a lot more value in that. So if you want to connect and engage with me, please accept all friend requests, unless it's obviously someone with two friends who's got three fake photos. If you're a legit person and you're friends with Daryl and you listen to his shit, I would love to chat with you because I'm an outgoing human being who likes to talk to people. So that's probably the best way to have a convo with me. And if there's stuff we can do together, great. If not, that's cool too. But I'm always looking to make new friends. Yeah.
Yeah, so check him out on Facebook. That's Gulliver, GULLIVER, and then got Giles.
Giles.
Giles, there we go. Giles, GILES, GILES. So go look up Gulliver Giles, GULLIVER, GILES. G is in Greek. Check him out on Facebook. Hit him up. Google some stuff. You can also check out, I think it was Iron Cage. The sales software is too as well if you need help with that. Gulliver, thank you for your time today. It's always an honor and a pleasure knowing you've got your own direct reports, your wife to take care of, your own followers. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience. And I think it was a good call.
The privilege, look, man, look, all of that stuff's important, but if you can't catch up with an old buddy and talk shit and add some value, hopefully, to some people listening, then what's the point of any of it? So yeah, it's great to make the time and take the time to do it. Hey, thank you so much for having me, and I hope that the people listening are having as much fun as we have had on this call.